Hi there. Welcome to The Preventable, the podcast giving you a seat at the table with conversations about the intersection of alcohol, drugs, and mental health in everyday lives. Take a seat and join us.
Welcome to The Preventable. With me today is somebody who I'm just so excited to get to know more about because I feel like I've always sort of admired you from afar. And when people drop your name, I'm like, oh, yes, I know her, which is so funny to you, I'm sure. But with me today is Elizabeth George, the Director of Community Investment with the St. Louis Community Foundation. What is a director of community investment? What does that mean?
Oh, hi, Nicole. I just wish I knew the answer to that. But, no, so the community investment department at the St. Louis Community Foundation does a number of different things. We're probably best known for working with a handful of grant makers, so private family foundations and donor-advised funds that are doing what we call competitive grant making. So you have to apply for grants instead of just somebody writing you a check. We handle all the, you know, grant applications and the reviews and get the board materials ready so that the foundations, the donors, can make decisions who they want to give grants to. So that's one thing that we do. But the other thing that we do, or I should say, and the other thing that we do, is we work with community-wide initiatives. Mm. So thinking about how the St. Louis Community Foundation can show up in community to advance our mission of building a more equitable and vibrant region now and forever, you know, through purposeful philanthropy. And so that could be anything from the COVID-19 Regional Response Fund was run out of the Community Investment Department. And that was a fund that had over 1,000 institutional, corporate, philanthropic, and individual donors to support the St. Louis region while we were going through the worst of the COVID pandemic. So,
I mean, how does something like that start? I mean, you don't have to get into the nitty-gritty, but does somebody call you up and say, hey, Elizabeth, I have an idea. We should probably create a fund because there's a real need that's about to open up?
Well,
Or does it start differently?
Well, it's sort of like that, but the person who made the phone call was it actually came from two places. You're going to laugh at this. So my boss, the CEO of the Community Foundation, was at a conference where the Seattle Foundation, the Seattle Community Foundation, got talking about the fund that they were developing. Because if you remember,
Seattle was a hot spot initially.
Initially, right. And I'm from Seattle, and my mother said
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and my mother sent me an article about the Seattle Foundation and how they had raised $15 million for their COVID fund. And so Amelia and I sat down together, and Amelia said, I think we need to do a COVID fund. And I said, I think we need to do a COVID fund. And that's how it started.
So, of course, you know, did you have to credit your mother with the idea?
I try to credit my mother for everything.
I was going to say, my mom's name is Barb, and Barb needs to be credited for pretty much everything. So somebody comes to you or you kind of collectively come up with this idea and say, for people who don't know, are you sourcing the dollars? Are you collecting and then helping distribute the dollars? Is it both and?
Both and. We started with about $100,000 from one of our field of interest, one of our funds that we have that we can use to draw upon when there's a community need, and some of our discretionary dollars. But the first thing I started to do was call the other foundations in town.
Oh, yeah.
And said, hey, listen, we're going to do this. Would you be at all interested in helping out? And so initially we had 9 or 10 foundations that all said they'd chip in anything from $5,000 to $250,000.
Wow.
And we we pulled together a community advisory council of service providers and
to have some
health
input on where the money's going.
Where the money should go. Public health professionals, you know, all those folks that, like, really know how to do this. And within 2 weeks, we made our first $350,000 of crisis grants.
Wow.
And that started us on our path. But then over the course of the next probably 10 to 12 weeks, as I said, we let people know about this fund, and the community came forward like you wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. It was just really, I get a little emotional about it. You know, it was just really awesome to see how our community, you know, the individuals, the corporations, we even had out-of-town corporations gave to try to support each other. It's a beautiful thing.
Has it always been about philanthropy for you? And I love what you said. You said purposeful philanthropy, which I think I like that qualifier. So has it always been about philanthropy?
For a long time. I've been in this world for, now I have to count, like a couple of decades because I'm old.
You've just had a lot of birthdays.
I've had a lot of birthdays.
There you go.
And they've been good. So, for probably, you know, 15, 20 years I've been working in the world of philanthropy. And I have to say, it's a great place to be because you get to support the network, the fabric of our nonprofit sector for, you know, really great organizations doing important work like Prevent Ed.
Thank you.
And we get to, at the St. Louis Community Foundation, because we provide funding across so many different dimensions, we get to know the arts. We get to know the environment.
Yeah, it's not like one, one cause or one topic.
Correct.
So when you talk about philanthropy, I mean, that's very different than fundraising.
Yes.
And there is an element of talking about money.
Yep.
Which most people are brought up, you don't talk about money.
You don't talk about money.
And it's difficult to ask for money, and you don't want to, you know, put a number to something. But things cost in this world. So, and I know that it's been a challenge for me in this role to really lean into not just fundraising, but also I believe in the work we do. But then how do you quantify that to talk about the amount of money that it takes, and you don't want to put money on a person's, like, you know, when you're talking about the value. I mean, that to me has been one of the most difficult things in this role. I mean, do you find that when you talk to people that talking about money, that thinking about money, and it's hard?
It's hard. It gets easier.
Yeah.
And also,
I will say you're right about that.
Yeah. It does get easier. The other thing is, I'm on the other side, and it's a whole lot easier to talk about it when you're giving it away than when you're having to ask for it, right?
Yeah. Unless they're not doing what they're supposed to do.
Unless they're not doing what they're supposed to do. Yeah. We try to avoid that.
Right, exactly. You're all about prevention, too.
We're all about prevention. You know, the other thing is, if something's not working, we try to work with the nonprofit organizations to try to figure out why it's not working and then think about solutions and how can we get to a good place where we can continue funding, and they can feel good about the work that they're doing with us as our partners. But in terms of talking about money, it is tricky. And understanding that you've got to live your mission, to lean into your mission, you've got to pay for it.
Yeah, it takes money to do that.
It takes money to do that. And you know, I'm a social worker, and you know, as you say, we didn't really learn a lot about talking about money in social work school. And we also, sometimes there's that sense of, you know, well, there's us and them.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
What we have to understand is, if we're really going to deal with issues like substance abuse, we have to be coming together to work on these issues together. And PreventEd is a business. It's a nonprofit business. So your goal is not to make a profit for your shareholders.
Right.
Your goal is to prevent substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? That's our widget we're selling.
That's the widget that you're selling. But you're a business.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we remember that we've got to run a business and it takes money to run a business, then, you know, if we think about it, like, this is just the cost of doing business.
Yeah.
The other thing that I have found is that if you know your donors, if you
right.
know who you're talking to, if you're talking to business people, they expect you to talk about money.
That's correct.
They expect you to come in and ask. And
they do. And using the phraseology that they're accustomed
right.
to and talking about KPIs and benchmarks and things like that. I mean, it's almost like, why aren't you talking about this if you're not talking about it?
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they do. And for those of you who don't know, a KPI is a key performance indicator.
Hey, you should host your own podcast. Nah. That's great.
No, you're too good at it. But, but, you know, they want to hear that they're getting value for
That's
their
right.
investment. And if you think about it as an investment instead of as a donation.
Interesting.
You're
yep.
investing in the work that we do.
Interesting.
You're investing in the outcomes of ensuring that our kids and adults are not going to be abusing substances.
Well, I just wrote that down. Investment. I'm going to use that in my next board one-on-one. That's good.
Yep.
That's good.
Yep.
So you talked about kind of this, I think, power dynamic, right,
yeah.
between a funder and
yeah.
an organization. And I don't know about you, but I think sort of a great equalizer in that was what we've experienced in the last 18 months or whatever it was with COVID. I know you all at the St. Louis Community Foundation, and there were several other funders who said, okay, well, what do we need? How can we support you? Clearly,
yeah.
that's not going to work. That's not going to happen. So how are we going to pivot? And I know the word pivot is like eye roll, you know, but that's really what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I know that there were funders like yours where, you know, they were having weekly calls to say, what do you need? I got a survey today, as a matter of fact, from a very large local funder saying, we hear staffing issues
mm-hmm.
are hitting you hard. What are people saying as reasons that they're not, you know, that they're leaving or that they're not coming on? What are you doing to incent people to come on? Like, how can we as a funder support you? So I don't know if you have noticed that, but I have seen a marked change in the dynamic of relationships or the feel of it. You know, between funder and fundee or whatever. Have you noticed that too?
Well, I'm just really excited to hear you say that.
And I'm not just blowing smoke. I'm
yeah,
serious.
Yeah. I hope that is happening. And I think, you know, there's some best practices in funding, like multi-year grants and general operating support. General operating support is like just what you need to keep your lights on,
yep,
right?
You exactly.
Know, you tell the organization, you figure out what you need to use these funds for.
And those are like that's the golden ticket.
Golden ticket.
If you can get unrestricted dollars, that's...
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. And a lot of funders historically have kind of said, I don't know about general operating support because I want to be able to see the KPIs
exactly.
for my program, right? Instead
Which
of...
Which you understand.
Right.
You understand. Like, you don't want to just give an organization money and say, meh, you figure out how it should work. At least that was what
right.
used to be the case. Right.
Right. And I think what happened in particularly those first 3 to 6 months of the pandemic was that what we saw was, you know, primarily institutional funders, so corporate donors and foundations and stuff, had you know, we were giving to this program or that program, and then poof, that program was gone.
Yeah, how can you fund a school program when schools are closed?
Right.
There you go.
Right. Right. And, you know, and it was you and a couple of others in our Bridgeton Landfill Community Project Fund grants that said, we need to have all the school people come together to figure out what we're going to do because our funding is to do school programs and we can't go to school. You know, there is no school right now.
Right.
Or online school. And so we as funders had to say, you know what? I don't want to ask these folks for the money back. They need those dollars now more than ever. And I have to trust that they're going to do what's right for their organization, what's right for their mission, and what's right for the community that they serve. And that's the part that I think we as funders have to remember. There's this you know, sort of new phrase of trust-based philanthropy.
Interesting.
Which is saying, we're going to work with you and we're going to trust you to know what you need more than we sitting in our, you know, offices, wherever, you know, mine's in a park, but you know,
it's beautiful, by the way.
Yeah, it's kind of nice. And, you know better what you need. You know better what your community needs. And if we think about, you know, what our mission is and what your mission is, it's all about serving our community.
Right.
And if we keep that as the focus, then I think we can do a better job of partnering with instead of funding and coming up with all sorts of...
It seems more like a partnership. Mm-hmm. And the word trust, I mean... That is not a word that I would have used, but right. Now that you're saying it, I'm like, yes, that is exactly what it feels like. And I think it's so bizarre that it took a global pandemic for that to happen. But, you know, I've been in this field long enough where I've been part of tons of meetings where it's like, how can we improve our relationship? What do you need from us? And then it doesn't necessarily go anywhere. And it's because a lot of times people are so paranoid, I think, about I can't let my funder see this, or I can't show weakness, or I can't say, wow, that didn't work. And I think sort of all bets were sort of off last year.
Right.
And so now we're going into, I mean, this episode will air kind of at the start of kind of end of year giving.
Yeah.
And people start thinking about, you know, end of the year and how can they make their charitable contributions? And well, I'm spending money on, you know, all these gifts and material things. So maybe I should make some charitable contributions. And oh, by the way, if I can get a tax deduction out of it, that's even better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is this like prime time for you as a philanthropist? Could I say that as a philanthropist?
Or
is this prime time for you?
Yeah. It is for the St. Louis Community Foundation, absolutely. So the way we're structured, we have donors who give to the Community Foundation and donors recommend grants. Mm. And then we also are doing some of our own, you know, end of year, if you wish. And it's really very exciting when it's busy. You know, nobody's twiddling their thumbs these days.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, it's a time when, as we're working with our donors, we get to really talk with them about what's important to them and what they want to have happen because they're being philanthropic or
like
being
what
charitable.
What impact do they want to make?
Right.
What legacy do they want to leave?
Exactly. And some people have never really thought about it in those terms. It's always a little surprising to me that, you know, some people, I've given to my schools, my kids' schools, my vendor's favorite charity, whatever that is. And they've never really thought about, you know, what makes me happy in my giving and where do I want to make a difference? And it's really fun to ask people those questions and to watch them really think through what that means and where, you know, what is the impact I want to have? And is it in the arts? Is it because I had a child who had a medical condition and I now want to support that medical condition?
Right.
Is it because I've been touched by people in my family or myself who've dealt with a substance abuse issue and I now want to prevent that from happening to anybody else or anyone else's
child? You kind of then get to be the channeler or the funneler for this person to really live out a legacy.
Live out their legacy.
When I heard it be discussed as a legacy a couple of years ago, it was like ding, 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 ding. Yeah. And to me, that's like, okay, that makes sense. Because, you know, especially when you're talking about end of life gifts, like people are like, whoa, no way. No, thank you. I don't want to talk about death. But you're not necessarily talking about death. You're talking about what is the legacy and what is the impact, your footprint that you want to leave on this world while you're here and while you're not.
And in the future.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much for coming. This time has flown by. I am so grateful for you to join me at the Preventable here. And I just really appreciate the way that you and your team at the St. Louis Community Foundation go about supporting agencies. It feels very genuine and it feels very, very much of a team effort.
Well, thank you. And it does take all of us to impact, to build a more equitable and vibrant region. And so thank you for the work that you do too.
If you like this conversation with Elizabeth George, if you want more, can you believe we got a funder at the table? This is great. If you want more, please consider rate, reviewing, and subscribing to The Preventable. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thanks for joining us at The Preventable, brought to you ad-free by PreventEd. PreventEd works to reduce or prevent the harms of alcohol and other drug use through education, intervention, and advocacy. Please visit their website at PreventEd.org. Like what you heard? Rate, review, and subscribe to stay up to date with what we are serving on The Preventable.